Just to give you, I know.
Why don't you scoot up? Well, go ahead and just.
We don't have enough time to really go through the whole thing. But there are these two things. One, this business about he says he questions this statement that I wrote. I was almost killed by a Pakistani immigrant in Jamaica who, in 1960, made it possible for me to receive 60 stitches in the head and legs without any kind of anesthesia, administered over several hours by a Canadian psychiatrist using improvised equipment, including a rag for me to bite. Okay, and he says that that's not true. Here's an affidavit from the doctor, and I was understating what happened. It turns out there were 100 stitches inside and 60 to 80 out. No anesthesia. I definitely would have bit the bullet if he hadn't been there.
So you were attacked and you were injured.
Yeah.
This is an affidavit from a doctor, A.A. Chaplin.
Right, who did the whole thing.
In Tarzana, California. Where did this happen?
In Jamaica, in the West Indies.
Well, how did this doctor happen to be in Tarzana, California?
Well, that's where he lives now.
But he was in Jamaica at the time.
Yeah, so was I. This was 31 years ago. And then there's this other thing about, for instance, Kakhtani is not the only journalist Halpern has tried to dupe. See, dupe. Most interviews with Halpern contain episodes about his boyhood, the brief stint he claims to have served in the British Merchant Navy. Now, it's hard to document things on hand, but here, for instance, it was very hard to get this, but from the Maritime History Archive in Newfoundland. And I won't tell you how hard it was. I mean, there's just quite a story. My ship was the Stone Pool, and these are consular certificates, which are really not necessary for this process. But this is a list of the crew of this ship. These are counter changes made in the foreign port because I got on in Rotterdam. The captain, by the way, was named Churchill. I used to tell people that. He used to dance with a broom. And I would say, yes, it's a British Merchant Navy. The captain was named Churchill. He danced with a broom. They really didn't believe me, but it was really true. And here on Seaman, this place is Seaman Engaged. Here I am, 21, American. That's my handwriting. My father's name and address in case I should die. First ship, 29th July 1967, Rotterdam, on board.
This is the British Merchant Navy.
British Merchant Navy. And everything in the article is like that. Everything in the article. For instance, at the end of the article, he said that I seemed reluctant and afraid to talk about politics. I spoke to him about politics for 10 hours. I regularly appear on networks, the big networks, speaking about politics. I write for the nation's
largest newspaper.
I was not reluctant or afraid to speak about politics. So I just wanted you to know.
But all in all, the article I thought was extremely flattering.
I didn't, because it made me out to be a liar, and I'm not. It made me out as someone who inflates his resume, and I haven't, and I never did. I think to me, I wasn't flattered. Of course, you didn't know what he got over 3 days. He interviewed me for 3 days. He left out the good stuff, and he put in the bad stuff, and he canted it so that everything that I actually have done in my life, according to him, was made up, when in fact I told him only the truth in those whole 3 days, nothing but the truth, and the whole truth, so help me God. And it's very hard to correct impressions. Overall, the article, I don't think this is like the Holocaust, for goodness sake, but nonetheless, it's something which, as a journalist, I feel should be set straight.
Well, I was talking to Erica John about a year ago. There had been an extremely unflattering article about her, I believe, in Esquire or Fame. And this article described how she was at a party and she threw up on her host, who was the wife of Peter Jennings, I believe.
That's pretty unflattering.
Very unflattering. And there were some other very unflattering assertions in this article. And I asked her a couple things about it. And she wasn't perturbed a bit. She said, in the long run, who remembers? So I kind of wonder if that's not the attitude for you to take. In the long run, who's going to remember all of that?
I remember. And my children remember. They came home from school. They're little children. They came home from school and they said, Dada, why do you lie? Why do you tell lies? And that was what most made me angry. Also, it's a question of the truth. The truth is very important, whether or not it has an effect, whether anyone remembers or not. It's important. And it in itself is important. So it's that's why I always want to set the record straight. No, and by the way, no matter what it's about, even if it's not about me, because it's just very important in itself, of itself, you know, as its own reward.
Now, just one other aside. It seemed to me that the author of the article, whose name escapes me, didn't indicate that you were not truthful so much as that you were a storyteller and that you wove interesting stories. And a lot of people do that.
Mm-hmm.
Joaquin Miller, the California poet, his whole life was a fabrication.
Yes, but mine is not. You see, and that's
I know,
that's
but everybody expected that of Joaquin because he fabricated stories that entertained people and hypnotized people and kept them interested.
Right. But here's the difference: was he the contributing editor of the nation's largest newspaper? Did he write political pieces that were read in the highest level of government? Did he have another side to him that demanded credibility? See, that's where I particularly, if I were merely a writer of fiction, I suppose I could take it more in stride. But it also affects my credibility as a journalist. I'm a straight working journalist also. And that's where I think it may have been aimed, although I can't assess anyone's motivations. But that's where it hit, as well as personally.
I think I know what you mean. You're talking about how people might view your politics.
Not just my politics, but my policy recommendations and my opinions, as I express them in the press, about serious subjects that you can't fool around with, that you can't tell stories about. That's where it hurt also. Also, I'm trying to damage control because I also might someday run for office, and I don't want this to go unchallenged because it's the kind of thing that one does not want in a politician, and for good reason. So it's something that I wanted to correct.
Why would you want to run for office after what you have going for you in terms of literature? Mitchner ran for office and failed. Gore Vidal ran for office.
What did Mitchner run for? Another Gore Vidal.
Mitchner ran for Congress in Bucks County.
Really?
Gore Vidal ran for Congress, I think, in Dutchess County, New York. Norman Mailer ran for mayor.
Yeah. Gore Vidal ran for Senate in California.
Who did?
Gore Vidal.
Did he also do that?
Yeah, and he also lost.
That. But why? I mean, you've got you have another 25 years, 30 years of writing ahead of you where you can write really powerful stuff. Why would you want to dispatch that to run for
office? I wouldn't dispatch it. You know what I do. I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning when I'm working. Not when I'm on tour, but when I'm working. And I write from 5 to about 8:15 or 8:20, which is a good solid 3 hours, which is about all I can do for real writing. And then I exercise, and I do the mail, I read the paper, and I have more or less 8 or 9 hours left. And in that time, that's why I'm a journalist also. I write, I do journalism, I garden, I do all kinds of things, but there are a lot of hours in the day when I can't just write. And since I'm not the type of writer who likes to drink and be dissipated, I want to use the time. So I use the time in political studies and other things. And therefore, why not take it to its limit?
If you did run for higher office, mm-hmm. What sort of office would you like to have?
Oh, I'd like to have an office with a window. And Senate.
Hello, David. David, this is Mark Helprin.
Hi.
David Levin.
You have a crazy handwriting.
David
has handwriting? Yeah.
How do you know?
I checked this. Didn't you sign in downstairs?
Yeah.
Couldn't make it out.
Oh.
David has laryngitis. David's one of your fans, so I told him he could sit in on the interview. Just to recap a little bit, David, Mark is very upset about the column, the article that was written about him, the profile in the New York Times Magazine, which he says is extremely inaccurate. And two, he wants to run for higher office. And that was...
May want to run.
What it would be, so Congress, Senate?
Senate. In fact, if I want, I have a place on the Republican ticket. In the 1992 Senate primary in Washington State, I've gone that far. I still haven't made up my mind about whether to do it or not. At this point, it doesn't look like I would win, but I have a chance anyway. And I don't know whether I want to do it, but I'm thinking about it, which is what everyone says who does this or not, and it's for good reason, because it's a big step and it's brutal once you attempt it.
Well, I understand that running for higher office, especially the Senate, is like a 24-hour-a-day job. When are you going to write?
From 5 to 8.
Not if you're running for office 24 hours a day.
Yes, because nobody gets up at 5 o'clock in the morning, except, in fact, once I got a call in the middle of the night in Seattle from Trent Lott, the senator from where Mississippi, and he had just been elected. And he called me up. It was what time? It was 2 o'clock in the morning. I the phone goes ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. And I said, "Hello," and he says, "Oh, who is this? This is Mark Edwin. I'd like to be blah blah." And I said, "What? What?" And he said, "This is Trent Lott. I want to be. I'm gonna give him a message for John." And all kind. He was just absolutely wide awake. It was 5 o'clock in the morning in Washington, in D.C. And I realized that these people get up and they're going like gangbusters at 5 o'clock in the morning. so maybe they work at that hour too. However, I just take 3 or 4 hours in the day and give it my best in writing and do the rest the other time. I think it's possible. Look, you know, one of the things I wouldn't do would be to speak to trade groups and collect honoraria and meet with PACs and other lobbyists, because one of the things I wouldn't do is take any PAC money or corporate money or union money or anything like that, so that I have a lot of time, because I wouldn't be servicing the money bags.
You would run as a Republican, conservative Republican? I guess that's really all there is.
Not in Washington, the state of Washington. The Republicans in the state of Washington are eclectic, certainly. Liberal. I mean, the label is hard to define. It would depend upon the issues of the day. But in Washington, one has to be, which is fine with me because I am, a strong environmentalist, which in Republican terms means that you don't think the world is going to end if we don't do a certain set of things, but rather that you want to do the best to keep the air clean and the water clean and make things beautiful. Not because the world is going to end. I don't think it will because of what man does, but rather because there are other good reasons for it. And in the tradition of Theodore Roosevelt, who was the first real conservationist in politics in America that I know of. And so I would say a Republican. It's hard to put the label. In foreign policy, I suppose I'd be called a conservative Republican. But in domestic policy, there are certain areas where I'm maybe even to the left of Democrats. I don't know.
Well, some of the issues raised in the Bush campaign against Dukakis were just terrible. I mean, they weren't issues of any substance, accusing Dukakis of being a card-carrying member of the ACLU. I mean, that's not an election issue, really. Or prayer in the school, flag burning. I mean, these are so minute. Or capital punishment, for example. These are not really issues for a president to get involved in, but they were issues, of course, that Bush could speak about because they caught attention. They were simple. I mean, everybody can get angry over, or many people can get angry over somebody burning a flag, but if you're talking about complex economic policy, that's tough to sink your teeth in. So Bush ran a very simplistic campaign. That was what worries me about Republicans, because of these phony issues that were used in that election campaign.
Well, Republicans are always worried about Democrats, because we remember the Democratic Convention and the absolutely stinging, vituperative, bitter and insulting oratory from Ann Richards, from Teddy Kennedy, where was George, all that kind of stuff. We think the same thing about the issues that the Democrats bring up. We think that, for instance, that to blame Ronald Reagan for the homeless problem is the same sort of thing, because as far as I see, the homeless are on the streets because, one, rent control, which is not a Republican position. Two, deinstitutionalization, which was never a Republican position. Three, the destruction of the family, the substitution of government for family. And you see, when your crunch comes, when you really need it, the government is not there the way your father and your mother could be. And so we think that the people are on the street because of policies that we've opposed. And yet, who gets the blame? Ronald Reagan, the Republicans, we have the same thing. There are always two sides to a story. And in my campaign, to come to try to make a synthesis of this, in whatever campaign I would run, I wouldn't campaign dirty. I wouldn't do it. And please, don't tell me that just Republicans do that. Democrats do it too. But Republican, Democrat, whatever, I wouldn't do it because it's not good. It devalues politics. American politics, I admit, are greatly debased by both parties. I wouldn't do that. I'm not going to run a negative campaign. I'm going to talk about the issues. I'm not going to go for anyone's jugular. I'm not going to start pulling personal stuff in or anything like that. That's if I run. I probably won't run.
Well, I kind of hope you don't. I think you have a more important agenda, and part of it is reaching out and touching us and making us feel and weep and laugh and cry. Before we get on to A Soldier of the Great War, the last time I spoke to you was about 1985, I think, and at that time, you were in the process of building a house. Oh, yes, please. You were building a house in Brooklyn Heights, or refurnishing a house.
Yeah, that was 80. Thank you. That was.
Take the lid off before you pour it.
It was 84, and that was hell.
Well, what happened? Because I thought you were going to be ensconced as a writer in Brooklyn, and all of a sudden I read someplace that you wound up in Seattle.
Yep. I'll tell you what happened. We bought an apartment, and then we got an architect, and it turns out that it was the architect's first job. We hadn't known, because he concealed it, or rather, by omission anyway, he never mentioned it. It was the first job that he had ever done, and he didn't know what he was doing. He was a good architect, but he didn't know about dealing with contractors and stuff. And he found us a contractor who was just, as far as I'm concerned, a crook. And the contractor just demolished the whole, he gutted the inside of the apartment, and then he just never showed up. So I fired him, and I had to do it myself. I did it with my own hands. At that time, there was a rubble strike, I mean a garbage strike. You couldn't take rubble and dump it. And the apartment was filled with rubble. In one corner, it went all the way up to the ceiling. So I had to sneak out at night with bags of rubble over my shoulders and carry them and throw them onto dumpsters in Brooklyn Heights. And once a cop car pulled up and they saw me, I was absolutely filthy. I looked like a bagman. I had this black soot all over my face and everything, because that's what happens when you're doing construction. And I was walking along stealthily with these two giant bags of rubble. And the cop said to me, "Hey, you know, you." And I said, "What?" And he said, "What do you got in there?" And I looked at him and I said, "I have all the gold of the East." And he said, "Put it down." And they got out of the car, and I mean, they were touching their guns and everything. And they looked, and they were looking through it. I said, "Would you like it? I'll give it to you if you want." But I really had a rough summer that summer, spring and summer. And then in the middle of that, my father died, which was the roughest part of all. And what happened was we had to move, because my mother, who has various afflictions, we had to take care of her. The apartment wasn't big enough for us, and even her house was not big enough, so we had to sell her house, which I had to renovate before it sold, and sell the apartment that I had just renovated, and then move to a place where we could all fit. And we had two children subsequently. So that's what happened to me. And when the book was opened and we said we can move anywhere, I did an analysis, and we moved to Seattle based on a lot of things.
The quality of life?
Yeah. Economics? Yeah. Economics. I knew then that it just occurred to me that the age of the commercial air fleet in the world, you know, most airplanes had been built in the 60s. And we're getting into the 90s, and I thought they're going to have to be replaced. And also, there's a tremendous expansion of air travel in the world as countries get wealthy enough to afford it. Who has 60% of the world market share for commercial aircraft? Boeing. Also, which city is placed best on the Pacific to take advantage of the Pacific Rim? In fact, Seattle. It's a day closer to Japan than by sea than any other city. It's very convenient. And then, of course, the natural beauty of it, and the fact that it's hardly populated. There are 5 million people in the whole state of Washington, and it's just less dense. When I come back to the east, it feels so strange because everything is so crowded. It's like Bombay out there. The air is filthy. You know, the air in New York is just filthy, and it's not good to have to breathe that. And the streets are so crowded now. I probably wouldn't notice had I stayed here. But when you're away for a while, you see it, and it's terrible. So I wanted a place that was better for my children to grow up in, and that had good, strong economic prospects, and that was very physically beautiful. And we found it.
And you're happy there?
Mm-hmm.
A good place for a writer?
It's a good place for anybody. It's a good place for anybody. The one drawback is that it rains a lot in the winter. And it's not so much rain, actually. It has less rainfall than New York City. But it's always gray. You don't see the sun for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks in the winter. But it's quiet and tranquil, I'll tell you that. So it is good for a writer, particularly.
So you have been busy. The one you did, Swan Lake, children's book,
mm-hmm.
with Chris Van Allsburg, and you began working on A Soldier of the Great War during that interim since 1984, plus
actually,
all of the family problems, the house,
yeah.
the moving, the kids.
Actually, I began working on Soldier of the Great War in 1980. But I finished Ellis Island while I was doing it. I finished Winter's Tale, and I did Swan Lake and Best American Short Stories. Went on tour for Ellis Island, Winter's Tale, Swan Lake, and then all of the familial problems and stuff. And we bought and sold 6 pieces of real estate from 1984, January 84, to November 87. Including renovations of 3 and a tremendous legal battle over one of them. And it was exhausting. I mean, it was sort of the yuppie curse of real estate, and now I think we're over it.
Yeah, it still surprises me that you are contemplating a run for the Senate when it seems to me the thing that you would want would be peace, quiet, routine, and the chance to do more work like a soldier of the Great War.
That's true, but on the other hand, I'm now just about 44, and I've noticed that as I get older, I don't have the snapback that I used to have, and I figure it'll get worse.
What do you mean by snapback?
I don't have quite the stamina and the ability to recover once I'm exhausted. For instance, today, I just ran for the first time in 5 years my usual Central Park running route, 7.5 miles of 6 miles in the park and 1.5 miles on the outside. And I was really, really exhausted when I did it. Last time I did it, I enjoyed it. I was speeding ahead and nobody passed me. Once Frank Shorter passed me, but that was no surprise. He just zoomed past me. But this time I counted, I passed 21 people, but 12 people passed me. So I'm really getting old. And obviously, it's going to get worse, so I figure I have certain strong years, and these are the years in which I can try to do something and that's interesting and give it my best shot, so they won't last forever. So I might do that. I'm not ready yet for the tranquility that you describe, although I love it, and it's probably what I should do, what I should see.
1980, you said you began A Soldier of the Great War, and mm-hmm. in some of the publicity material... The inspiration for Alessandro, who was the lead character in the novel, came from your bumping into an old man at a railroad station. Tell me about that.
Well, that I that I consider the genesis of the book. The incident occurred in the summer of 1964 when I was 17 years old. I was traveling throughout Europe with a knapsack, walking a lot of it, hitchhiking. Sometimes going on trains, and I found myself in the middle of the night in a little town in Calabria. I believe it was Potenza Inferiore, and I walked into the station. And now I went back there. Potenza Inferiore is—it's fairly modern, you know. And even after the earthquake, I mean, even before the earthquake, it had modernized. Now after the earthquake, it's modernized again. But then it was an ancient Italian village. And 1964 was light years away from what Italy is now in terms of its culture development, especially the South. There were peasants in there, women dressed in black, chickens in wooden cages. It was late at night, hot. People were spitting on the floor. It was really something out of a good movie. And I walked in, they thought I was a German. They always thought I was a German in Italy. In fact, in Naples, I was stoned because they thought I was a German. And that's an irony. But standing against one wall was an old man who had very effulgent, elegant white mustaches and flowing white hair, and he was in a white suit. He had one leg. He was leaning against his crutches, and he had a row of medals over his heart. And this old guy, this vecchio in Italian, looked at me with tremendous hatred. You know, he sort of sneered, and his eyes lit up. And I looked him back because I knew that he thought I was German, and he had obviously the Germans had taken his leg. He undoubtedly had taken some Germans' leg, but they took his, and it didn't grow back. So I stared him back, and I didn't drop my eyes. And of course, it was a challenge to him. So we had a staring contest that lasted for, I didn't measure the time. I never wear a watch. I didn't even then. But it lasted for a long, long time until the train came. And during that time, his face changed, his expression changed, because he must have thought about it. And you know, at the end, it was a fatherly expression that he had. And he smiled at me. And I was very much impressed by him. I wanted to know what it was that made him the way he was. I've always been impressed by and interested in these old people who have great stories. Now, I know that he must have had a great story. Obviously, he had a great story. You can tell just by looking. I didn't speak to him, but I did feel that he had entrusted me with something, or at least I felt that I wanted to be entrusted with it, and then I didn't think of it for 20 years. And the next thing you know, actually 16 years, only 16 years, not so long, the next thing that happened was it came to life. It was like a locust. And I wrote a book which could have been his story.
It's got terrific sweep in it, and while it has a lot of realism in it, there are some fantastical elements to it, too. There's a nice fantasy sweep to it, like Winter's Tale. But I know that your intent was to do something entirely different from Winter's Tale.
Well, not entirely. My father said to me after Winter's Tale, my father was schooled in the realist school of fiction, and he thought that really that was the only one. It's not. It's the one that's dominant. Represents the triumph of reason and the Enlightenment. But many people unfortunately think that that's the only way literature is realistic. But in fact, that's a new current. It's something fairly new, and it's rather small in comparison to the large historical picture. I mean, it's only been around since the beginning of the century, really. Or it developed in the 19th century. And he said, to satisfy his tenets, the next book you write, you should make sure that nothing happens that violates the laws of physics. And I said, my father always, if I were about to close the door, my father would say, close the door. See, he had an uncanny ability to do that. If I was about to clean up my room, he'd say, clean up. Now, not that he ever had to say that, because I was always cleaning up after my parents and everybody else, including the maids in the hotel. But if I were to, whatever I was going to do, he would always say, do that now, just before I was going to do it. And I had decided to do that. I said, you're right, I will. And that's what I did, because Winter's Tale leaned too much in that direction, even in my view. Although I think it was misinterpreted by people who are hostile to that kind of thing because they don't understand it. And also on another level, which is that I think that Winter's Tale is not so fantastical in view of its subject, which is the city of New York. And as I told you in the beginning, I'm interested primarily in truth for its own sake. And I think that the city of New York is a fairly good, well, put it this way, I think that the city of New York deserves the treatment that I gave it in Winter's Tale. Because if you think that it can be rendered just realistically, just sort of as a, like a reporter, it won't. It won't submit to that kind of portrait, because it's too big, it's too deep, it's too interesting, and it's too much out of control. At the time, there was a book called Delirious New York about, it was a book of paintings, sort of in the Dali style about New York. And I remember looking at it and thinking, this is not entirely fantastical. There's something very real about it. The city is quite crazy. In fact, a lot of things in Winter's Tale that people think of as being just crazy, fantastical stuff are things that I actually saw and would record and make notes about. You know, things that crazy people said on the street, or things that I got from history. People think that I made it all up. You know, they always think that about things that I say or do. But Peter Lake actually existed in New York. He was called Grand Central Pete. Beverly Penn existed, a real person. They didn't. It wasn't the characters that I had, but they were all based on real characters. The Short Tails, the gang of little midgets with bowler hats, they existed. They worked under the piers in Corlear's Hook. I mean, the strangest things have happened in the city, stranger than fiction. So it wasn't entirely that fantastical, although I admit horses do not fly.
Well, you have a lot of strange and wonderful characters in A Soldier of the Great War. And, you know, this is probably going to surprise you.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite character is he's the soldier who was killed, who was fascinated, obsessed by stationery.
Mm.
Because
the Milanese.
The Milanese. I am obsessed and fascinated by stationery stores. I love stationery stores. I love the Staples catalog. I love paper clips, and it's just my office at home is like that. I have everything in a neat stack in its proper place, and I look for more of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably a very unlikely character to be your favorite, but it was.
Half the people in stationery stores are there because they have this obsessive love of stationery. And when they buy stationery, it makes them feel good. Now, the other half of people who have to buy stationery for whatever practical reason think that people like you and me, because I share that, are crazy. They probably think that they don't understand what we're talking about, because if you don't have that obsession about stationery, then you can't understand it. But I certainly agree. My office is, you should see it. It's just, and there's no, you cannot develop an office too much. Someday, I'm going to have an office which has a counter, with a long counter with wires that go down through the, hidden wires, with a fax machine and the computer and the copying machine and everything all just so, and cabinets with the supplies. I keep on making it better and better and better, but it never ceases. I'll work on it till I die. The perfect office.
Well, being a New Yorker, a Manhattanite, I'll never have the perfect office. There's just not enough space for it.
Mm-hmm.
The other character, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, Orfeo the dwarf?
Orfeo.
Orfeo.
Yeah.
Orfeo.
Yeah.
He's the scribe, the head scribe, the man who is obsessed by the holy sap. Tell me about that.
The gracious sap?
The gracious sap.
The holy blessed sap?
Yeah, the holy
that falls blessed, from the cloak of the blessed sap. One as he goes through the universe and his cloak hits the outer edge of the burning planet. Well, Orfeo was he was the son of midgets in the circus, in a gypsy circus. And his parents died when he was 4 years old, I believe, which was, of course, a great blow. And they were buried by the side of the road someplace, because the circus was itinerant, and this was in the 19th century. And as he grew, he was too tall to be in the circus as a dwarf, because he wasn't quite a dwarf. He wasn't normal size either. But the circus threw him out because he was too tall, which is rather ironic, because he was quite small. And they just said, sorry, you can't stay with us. Also, he was not a gypsy, so they thought that he was not fit for their society. And he ended up in Rome. When he got off the train in the station, The first office he wandered into was a law office that needed a scribe. That's how he became a scribe. And he was in the book, he has already reached a very advanced age, and he's the chief scribe in the law office of Alessandro Giuliani's. Alessandro Giuliani is the main character of the book, of his father. And Orfeo is totally crazy.
He believes that the typewriter is going to mean the ultimate destruction of the world.
That's right.
Wonder what he would think about computers today.
Well, one of the things that Alessandro says about him later on is that he should have rolled with the punch, really, because Alessandro said, and this is where he's saying this in I forgot whether he says it in 1964 or in the 20s, but he says, in both, it wouldn't matter whether it was 64 or the 20s, because to be prescient like that, it would be the same thing in both those years. He says, someday even the typewriter will be obsolete. Of course, in 1964, you couldn't imagine that the typewriter would be obsolete. However, today it is. You can hardly buy a regular typewriter. I tried to get one for my mother, and they just don't exist. But he thought that the typewriter was going to be the ruination of the world because he thought that writing with a pen was a beautiful thing. Of course, he was a scribe. It was also threatening to him. It was going to put him out of work. But he saw something else in it. He saw the mechanization of humankind. And he saw, in a sense, industrial alienation. Instead of having people writing, operating slowly, carefully, making curves that bend with their own fingers touching it, it's a machine-like actions, uniform, all the same in a staccato rhythm. And he objected. He was objecting to the death of that era and the dawn of the totally industrialized age. That's one of the things he was objecting to. It wasn't just typewriters.
Orfeo becomes the head scribe in the War Department, and I guess Alessandro's adventures are almost guided by him. He sends him all over Italy
to some extent, and that is, people have pointed out that that's a departure from total realism, but most of those people haven't been in the army. For anyone who is in the army, you know that the bureaucrats who sit in the offices have complete, absolute, total power over the enlisted personnel anyway, and they're the cause of exactly that kind of adventure or misadventure. And I had a lot of that experience myself in the army. I was rocketed like a projectile from one part of the country to another by various clerks who just went, a little check on a piece of paper, we'll put you here, we'll put them there, and they do it sometimes vindictively and everything. So that wasn't totally unrealistic, especially given that it was the Italian bureaucracy.
How historically correct is some of the information here? How much of it come out of your imagination? The sweep of the battles, for example, the execution in the prison of all those prisoners every day, 10, 12 prisoners being shot. And the battle scenes and so forth. Did this spring from your imagination, or did these things actually happen?
Strangely enough, yesterday I had a 3-hour interview with an Italian journalist from La Repubblica, which is probably the most important literary paper in Italy. It's a newspaper. And I asked him whether it was credible to an Italian who grew up in Italy and knows Italian. He said, very much so. And he could hardly believe that I hadn't researched it. I hadn't. I'm widely read in the subject, but I hadn't researched it. To answer your question specifically, there was no prison, as far as I know, called Stella Maris, where they did the executions. But in the First World War, in Italy, as well as other places, they did do decimations of the ranks. You know that. When a battle went badly, the commanders would take every 10th man from whatever unit was fighting, shoot them. Or if there were a mutiny, they'd take every 10th man. Bang. Wow. They did that. French generals fired on their own men all the time. Sometimes, I believe, even with artillery. That was the way the war was run. The world was almost more insane in World War I than it was in World War II. So as far as the executions go, this wasn't a specific incident where they took place. But it's very true to the spirit.
As you wrote A Soldier of the Great War, did you have this pretty well imagined before you actually began writing or do?
No, what I do is
the episodes spring to life as you began to work.
Yeah, well, this is what I do. I think of a last line. In this case, it was a couple of sentences, last paragraph, really. And then that's the first thing I think of when I do anything, no matter what I write. And then I write toward it. And I don't, even though I'm compulsively neat and organized, and my files and my desk and everything are just they make some people close their eyes and sigh when they see them because they just can't believe it. Nonetheless, for writing, it's all in my head. And I allow myself for every book, even this book, which is 800 pages or more, I forgot how many exactly, it's 1,500 manuscript pages, I allow myself only one sheet of 8x10 paper for all planning, outlining, and notes. And you should see it. It looks like the Rosetta Stone at the end of the book. But that's the only aid that I'll allow myself. I think of the last line and then write to it. You think if you know the last line, then when you start out, it all comes together almost of its own accord. It's a great technique. It's like taking a rock and throwing it out into a lake and then swimming for it and diving for it and getting it.
You have entered into kind of an unusual contractual arrangement with Horace Brayson Jovanovich, haven't you? You have a multi-book contract, don't you?
Yeah.
How does that work?
It's
X number of novels, X number of books or short stories?
I am obligated to deliver to them three novels and two other books, one of which must be a collection of short stories and the other of which can be either a collection of short stories or a nonfiction work at my option. I have no time limit. I can take the rest of my life if I want, so I have no deadlines. I can't write for a deadline except for a newspaper piece. It was done against the advice of most of my people who were advising me, because they believed that I would earn more money if I just jockeyed each book into position. But I did it because I was not interested in earning the maximum amount of money, but rather in making the conditions under which I could write without having to worry about money, without necessarily being... I mean, the problem with money, part of the problem with money is that nobody ever is satisfied with... they never know when they have enough. They always want more. My father always said to me that one of the things that would make you... happy in your life is to decide what it is that you want and then not to adjust your aims once you've achieved it and just then turn to other things. So I essentially am set. I know how much money I wanted. I got it. And I'm not stimulated to want more. I frankly never understood someone like Donald Trump or any of these megabuck type of tycoons. What are they after? You can only sleep in one bed at a time. You know, you can only. They want the symbol of wealth. They want people to think that they're distinguished. I don't know what they want, but whatever it is, it's very unsatisfying. In the end, it's nothing. It's less than nothing. It's like it's ashes. And I was not interested in working, jockeying every book into position and going through auctions and getting more and more and more money. I knew what I wanted. I've got it, and I'm very happy with it. I don't need more.
Now, you have Swan Lake came out 2 years ago. Beautiful, beautiful children's book.
Beautiful book.
Illustrated by Chris Van Allsburg. Mm-hmm. You're going to do another children's book, aren't you?
Two.
And this is for a different publishing house.
Yes, for Viking. Chris and I have a contract with Viking, and we're going to do two more for them.
Are these retellings of...
No. Swan Lake wasn't really a retelling because there was no story. You see, the story, the ballet, the scenario of the ballet was made up by Tchaikovsky's confidant, stage manager, aide, whatever his name was, Begachev. And he was an alcoholic who, on short notice, had to put together the story for a ballet once Tchaikovsky had given him the music, which had already been written. Tchaikovsky didn't know what the music for Swan Lake was going to be about. He just wrote it as music for his that he played for his children. He did it for his children. And then he gave it to Begachev, and Begachev said, I'll make a ballet scenario of it. And he put together a whole bunch of myths. And I must say that without the music and without the stage effects and the choreography, the story itself is not much. In fact, it's very poor. It's inadequate. There's an evil magician named Von Rothbart. You see, this will give you the idea of Begachev's level. And the swans commit suicide by drowning. I mean, that's rather silly. So what I did was I tried to honor the do homage to the music and to the ballet and the staging of it, which is something that has lasted for these many, many years, and which is part of the Western tradition, by writing a story which was better than the Begachev story, which was not hard. It's not a prideful thing to have done, because, I mean, it was really, truly very poor. And I wanted to make the story one that was that would move one's emotions and appeal to one's intellect at the same time. That would be beautiful and yet would be interesting and also would be emotional. And so that's what I set out to do. And the story is different from the ballet, although it incorporates everything in the ballet in the story. In other words, if you read the story, you'll see that everything that happens in the ballet happens in the story, but the story gives it new explanations. For example, in the ballet, the tutor, who was played when I saw the ballet by Nureyev, even though he was past his prime, he did a good job just because he had a lot of presence. The tutor is a drunk in the ballet, inexplicably. He's just a drunk. In my story, he's actually not a drunk. He's pretending to be a drunk for a very good reason. See, it's part of the story. That kind of thing. I gave them motives for all these things, and I hope that I made made it something which is affecting. In fact, I think I've succeeded, because a lot of parents have written me and told me that in fact it affects them very greatly and their children.
Mark, I know, kind of wrap things up. If you obviously been preoccupied with the celebration of your new book, you're going around the country on a large tour, about a 10-city tour.
16 cities.
16. Yeah. And that's, you'll be doing that for another couple of weeks.
Until July sometime.
That means you have put on hold work on your next project, huh?
Yeah, I was going great guns on it, and I had to stop to do this. In fact, the planning of this and then the recovery, because, you know, when you get home and you have to do mail and you have to do gardening and you have to all kinds of things to be done. I figured that it took 2 months to plan. And I was trying to work, but I was just interrupted constantly.
Not 2 months to plan the trip.
Yeah.
I mean, the tour.
The tour. But and then it'll take a month to recover, and the tour itself will last over 3 months going in and out. So you're talking about 2 plus 3 plus plus 1, is that what it was? So that's 6 months.
But you said that you had promised Harcourt, Brazen, Jovanovich 3 novels. Have these been pretty well planned in your mind about what you're going to write?
Well, I'm working on one of them. That's what I was really going strongly on, and I was having a great, great time, I must say. And I hated to leave it, and I'll get back to it in September, probably. If I run for Senate, this is going to be a problem, because I have a certain timetable in my own mind, and running for Senate is going to blow that apart. But I was having a lot of fun, and I didn't want to leave on this tour, but I had to, because I promised them that I would do so.
And well, I have to tell you, you don't have to worry about the Senate, Mark. Writers never get elected. You can give up that idea right now.
I'll tell you what. If I do, will you, let's say if I win the primary, okay, will you come out there and cover me?
Well, if I get my boss to send me, I will. The way it works around here, you have to pay your own way to do anything.
I mean, it would be great to get as much coverage as possible.
Because they vote for you out there, not here.
Yes. Oh, you're just in local in New York?
Local in New York, and I don't think I have a station in Seattle. The closest one to you carrying the show is KCBS in San Francisco.
Well, maybe we can hear that.
A Soldier of the Great War. It's a beautiful novel, Mark Hellerbrunn. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.